find string duals for large n QCD or large n Ingalls theory or large n equals one supersymmetric Ingalls theory in order to understand better various strong coupling properties of these theories. Is the echo too strong? Or? Hope it's okay. And the method that we're using is to try to find theories that would have some dimensionless parameter such that in one limit of that parameter we get the large n Ingalls theory that we're interested in, and in the other limit we could have a good supergravity approximation in which it's relatively easy to do computations and to see the qualitative properties that we're interested in. And the first example out of three that we'll discuss of this general framework is the example of the deformed n equals four Ingalls theory, which is often called the n equals one star theory. I guess I should have mentioned that name. And that theory is given by the n equals four super Ingalls theory, to which we add a mass deformation that gives a mass to the extra scalar field and to some of the extra fermion fields, either all three either three of the four fermion fields, as I wrote here, or all four of them. So I'll start by discussing the supersymmetric case, where we just give a mass via a superpotential. As we discussed last time, this theory has many classical supersymmetric vacua given by the following equation, which enables us to relate classical vacua to n-dimensional representations of SU2. And the vacua that we'll mostly be interested in are vacua that have a mass gap. The simplest example is what we call the Higgs vacuum, where the phi I are given by the n-dimensional representation of SU2, and there already classically the SUN gauge group is completely broken, and there aren't any strong quantum effects. The vacua that we're most interested in are what's called the confining vacua, where the SUN gauge group is not broken, and that's where we can connect at low energies to the pure Ingalls theory or pure supersymmetric Ingalls theory that we're interested in. So in those vacua, classically, phi is zero, and there's no breaking of the gauge symmetry, and quantum mechanically, we expect in those vacua to get confinement and Gugino condensation leading to n separate quantum vacua. And if n is not prime, then there are also intermediate vacua, writing n as p times q, where classically the SUN gauge group is broken to SUP, and then quantum mechanically, these split into p vacua. And as we mentioned, there are also many other vacua that don't have a mass gap because there classically the gauge group is broken into some U1 factors, which remain also in the quantum theory. So we analyzed this on the field theory side in detail yesterday. On the string theory side, as we described, the string theory solutions that are dual to these deformations should be backgrounds, which asymptotically should just be ADS5 cross S5, corresponding to the fact that at high energies, this field theory is just the same as the n equals four Ingalls theory. At energies large compared to this mass scale, M. And the deformation is encoded by the fact that there is some bulk field chi, which is dual to this, to the operator trace lambda lambda in the field theory, which we deform by an operator of dimension three. And that field should behave near the boundary of anti-de Sitter space as M times Z, where Z is this radial coordinate that we're using, which goes to zero near the boundary. So this field goes to zero near the boundary, and we have ADS5 cross S5 there, but when we go to small values of Z, it should behave linearly in Z in this form. And as I mentioned, if we just naively try to solve the supergravity equations with these boundary conditions, we find solutions that are singular so that they don't make sense, which means that we have to do something beyond supergravity in order to understand these deformations on the string theory side. So are there any questions about what we did yesterday before I continue? Okay, so what can we do to desingularize these solutions and go beyond supergravity? So there are two hints as to what we should be doing. The first hint is that when we turn on this deformation, then these fields chi, which are scalar fields on the ADS5 dual to these operators trace lambda lambda, from the 10-dimensional point of view, they come from modes of the NSNS and Ramond two form fields with some indices along the compact direction of the S5. And because these fields are linear in Z, then that means that we're really turning on some three-form fluxes of some three-form fields, at least, of the NSNS three-form and Ramond three-form fields. And if you try to, and so we're turning on these fields, and these fields grow as we go to the interior based on this asymptotic form of the solutions. So these fields grow in the interior of the anti-de Sitter space, which is no longer anti de Sitter, of course. And in fact, the solutions are singular in some sense because these fields grow without bound and blow up in the interior. Now, this suggests that perhaps one way to desingularize the solution would be to introduce some source for these fields, which would enable us to find non-singular solutions in which the growth of these fields in the interior is just explained by the fact that they have some source, and naturally they need to grow near their source. A source for these three-form fields is given by either D5 range in the case of the Ramondre-1 three-form, or the Nevis-Schwarz-5 range, which is the source for the Nevis-Schwarz three-form. So this suggests that maybe we need to put in the interior some five ranges of this type that would give a source to these fields and not really cut off their growth, but just explain why these fields blow up in the interior of the solution. So of course this is just a hand waving argument. Another hand waving argument for what the configuration should look like and what we need to add to the supergravity is given by analyzing the form of these Higgs vacua. So in the Higgs vacua, as I mentioned, these matrices phi are just given by the n-dimensional representation of SU2. So that's just classically the form of the matrices phi, but in these vacua, because the SUN gauge group is completely broken, then the classical approximation is actually good, at least if we're at weak coupling, and we can really trust this description these values for the scalar fields would not be changed much also in the quantum theory. And so in this vacua, the fields phi I are really non-zero. Now, if we just start from ADS 5 cross S 5, and we try in the n equals 4 theory to give some VEVs to these scalar fields phi, so I'm not sure if you discussed this in the previous lectures on ADS 5 cross S 5, but generally, if the phi I are non-zero, or say if you have some non-zero eigenvalue for the phi I, just in the n equals 4 Young-Mills theory, then this maps on the ADS 5 cross S 5 side to putting a D3 brain in the bulk with a position which is given by these values of the phi I. So this is natural given the original derivation of the ADS CFT correspondence from some new horizon limit of D3 brains where these phi I's just came from the positions of the D3 brains. So having non-zero eigenvalues for the matrices phi I maps to having some D3 brains in the bulk with a radial position and an angular position given by the VEVs of these six scalar fields phi. Now also in the Higgs vacuum, as we said, the matrices phi are non-zero, so we can try to also give these vacua an interpretation in terms of D3 brains in the bulk. And in fact, if we compute the sum of the absolute values of the phi I squared in this matrix, so that's easy to compute because these phis are just a representation of SU2, and that's just related to the Casimir of this representation of SU2, so one can find that this goes like m squared n squared so this of course is a matrix, but as a matrix equation, you can find this equation with the identity matrix appearing on the right hand side. So in some sense, that means that the eigenvalues of these matrices phi I sit on a sphere. Naively, you might think that this is a five sphere because these phis are three complex matrices. But in fact, when we choose these phis to be representations of SU2, then the generators of SU2 are Hermitian. So we're really turning on just one real scalar field out of each of these complex scalar fields phi I. So what this equation really means is that the eigenvalues of these matrices sit on a two-sphere, because each of these phis, you can think of it just as some real matrix, which corresponds to these Hermitian generators, which appear in the classical solution. And then I here, of course, goes from 1 to 3. So this gives us an equation for a three-sphere. Now, here I was naive because I was talking here about the eigenvalues of the phi I, even though this equation, of course, tells us that we cannot really diagonalize all the matrices phi I simultaneously because they don't commute with each other. But if we could diagonalize, say, all the matrices phi I simultaneously subject to this condition, then that would really tell us that we should have some configuration where in the ADS 5 process 5 space, that we have these three brains that are spread out on some S2 inside the S5 defined by that equation and sitting at some radial position Z0, which is goes like 1 over alpha prime m times n, which is related to this absolute value squared of these matrices. So at least, so say if we just had a particular eigenvalue, say the first eigenvalue of all these matrices obeying an equation like this, then we would map that to a D3 brain that sits on at some point on this sphere inside S5 and at some particular value of the angular variable. Now, so naively, we might map such a configuration to any D3 brains that sit on the sphere. Now, as I mentioned, that's not really correct because we have this, because these matrices don't really commute. So we can't really diagonalize them and map them to local eigenvalues. And what that's usually referred to is the fact that these eigenvalues don't really sit on a sphere, but they sit on a fuzzy sphere where their positions are not really well defined. And the interpretation of that for D-brains was found, well, it was first found in the context of matrix theory, and it was then analyzed by Rob Myers for the case of D-brains in flat space. And it was found that when you have D-brains with the matrices phi, which label their position obeying an equation like this, so again, if the phi's just commute, then their eigenvalues give the position of the D-brains, but when the phi's don't commute and obey an equation like that, it was found that means that a DP brain, that you can replace the NDP brains, which you originally had, by a single DP plus 2 brain, which wraps on the sphere given by the naive positions of these eigenvalues. And of course, for this to be consistent, this DP plus 2 brain has to be able to carry the DP brain charge. And that's possible if you turn on some n units of gauge field flux on the world volume of this DP brain. So because of the Wesselmino term in the world volume action of the DP brain that hopefully you heard about already, then there is a coupling of the gauge field on the world volume of the DP brain to the Ramon-Ramon fields, which means that if we have a DP brain on a sphere with n units of gauge field flux on it, then it carries exactly n units of DP brain charge, and it's possible. So at least in terms of the charge, it's consistent to replace these n DP brains by this single DP plus 2 brain with this charge. So this suggests that the correct interpretation of these vacua should be given not just by supergravity, but by supergravity together with some 5 brain sitting somewhere in the space. So if this is the z-coordinate of ADS space, so as we said, for very small z, the solution should look like ADS 5 cross S5 with the usual n units of 5 form flux on the S2. And this form of the solution suggests that at some specific radial position given by this equation, here we should have some 5 brain sitting. Now this 5 brain it fills the R4 directions of the anti-de-Sitter space, which are labeled here by these X mu's. Of course, we don't break the Lorentz invariance in these directions, and it also fills a 2 sphere inside the S5. Again, just based on the form of this equation. So the suggestion is that we should have a solution where, well, for small values of z, it's just described by supergravity, but here on the inside, we have some D5 brain in a configuration like this that carries also these n units, well, such that the flux of the gauge field of the D5 brain on this S2 is proportional to n, so that it carries n units of D3 brain charge. So these were, of course, just hand-waving arguments that maybe the solution, at least for the Higgs vacuum, should take this form. And, of course, what you have to do next is to try to actually see if, indeed, you can find a consistent solution to supergravity where you you're supposed to solve the supergravity equations, again, with the boundary conditions written over there, and with one addition to supergravity, which is putting in this d5 rain source at the specific radial position and at these specific angular positions. Now, this is a well-defined problem because we know exactly how the d5 rain couples to all the supergravity fields, so it's just some source, which is point-like in the transverse direction, and we know exactly how it couples to all the fields. So this is still a well-defined problem of just solving differential equations. And so this problem was analyzed by Polchinski and Strassler, and they argued that indeed it was possible to find solutions to supergravity plus this source, which have this form. The solutions have still not been constructed exactly, so the exact form of these solutions is not known. But the solution is known, of course, in the asymptotic region, and it's also known in the region close to these d5 rings, and there are arguments that it should be possible to extend this to an exact solution for all the positions. And of course, the crucial thing in finding the solution is that these d5 rings, well, you can only find a solution like this indeed when the d5 rings are in some specific position. So all the scalar fields on the d5 ring are massive. It doesn't have any moduli that enable it to move. And the position of this d5 ring is indeed exactly the one that you would find from these naive hand-waving arguments, namely the one that corresponds to these vevs of the scalar field. So it's natural to interpret this solution with a single d5 ring here as the solution that corresponds to the Higgs vacuum of this field theory, again, just based on mapping the eigenvalues of the phi i's in this way. So are there any questions about this? Okay, now what does this solution look like? So asymptotically, as I said, it looks like ADS5 plus S5. Then here you start having these freeform fields growing as you go to the interior, and of course they eventually blow up the Ramon-Ramon freeform field eventually blows up near this d5 brain. Now in this region, as I said, you have these n units of phi-form flux on the S5. However, as you go through these d5 brains, because these d5 brains themselves carry n units of phi-form flux, then on the other side of them, you actually don't have any phi-form flux anymore. And the solution actually for large values of z, you don't have any phi-form flux anymore, and the solution around here actually just looks like flat space. So here on the other side of these brains, you just have a flat space, which eventually just so the phi sphere just eventually shrinks to a point at some maximal value of z here, since it doesn't have any flux anymore that would prevent it from shrinking to a point. So the solution smoothly interpolates between being an ADS5 cross S5 solution near the boundary and just being flat space in the interior, with, again, the only addition to supergravity being this single d5 ring, which is a source for the gravity fields. And the solution is the supergravity approximation is good in the solution as long as we're in this large lambda regime where the ADS5 cross S5 solution is reliably described by supergravity. The back reaction of this d5 ring is, of course, small because we're at weak string coupling, and also the curvatures everywhere in the solution are small, except perhaps near the region of the d5 ring, but we know how to treat d5 rings in string theory and also just to treat them as a source in gravity, so we do have a good description of this full solution, except for this fact that the exact solution is not yet known. So this gives us the description of the Higgs vacuum. And of course, that's not the vacuum that we're really interested in. We're actually interested in these confining vacua. So next we have to ask, what are other solutions that we can find? So one thing you could try to do instead of looking at this solution is to look at solutions where you have more than one d5 ring sitting at some radial position. And that's, so you can try to find solutions where you have, say, p d5 rings sitting here at some value of the radial coordinate. And that's natural because when you have PD5 rings, then one has you have an SUP gauge theory sitting on their world volume. So this would realize in a natural way this breaking of the SUN gauge group to SUP, which you see classically in the gauge theory. And if you had a solution like this, then you would also see the SUP gauge fields living on these D5 ring world volumes. And indeed, one can find solutions of this type, where you have here p-d-phi variance instead of a single d-phi variance. So the solutions are quite similar to the previous case, except that you now have p-d-phi variance, and also the radial position of these phi variance changes. It's given by, I guess, q here instead of p, where q is n over p. But otherwise, these solutions are quite similar. So for every one of these vacua where classically SUN is broken to SUP, you can find a solution in the bulk that has p d phi variance in it, and you interpret the SUP gauge theory that lives on the world volume of these d phi variance as the gauge theory that you get from this classical breaking of SUN to SUP. Of course, as we mentioned in the field theory, classically you get this SUP gauge group, but quantum mechanically at low energies, the strong coupling effects of this SUP would lead it to confine, and you would see that it actually has p vacua and so on. And the same should happen in the string theory. So classically, by just analyzing the spectrum of open strings on this d-phi brain, you would find this SUP gauge theory. But of course, that gauge theory itself would eventually become strongly coupled at low energies and confined, but you don't see that in the classical string theory solution, just like you don't see it in the classical gauge theory solution. So this provides a description for all these intermediate vacua. However, we should worry about when we can really trust this approximate gravity description of these vacua. The back reaction of these d phi variance on the background is proportional to the string coupling times p. That's a general claim. If we have p d phi variance, then the open string coupling of these d phi variance is given by g string times p, the number of d variance, and also the back reaction is proportional to this. So we can only really trust this description of these vacua when g string times p is much smaller than one. And of course, as I mentioned, we also need g string times n to be much larger than one to be able to trust supergravity. So in this regime, where p is much, where g string times p is much smaller than one and g string times n is much bigger than one, in this regime, we can trust supergravity together with these sources to describe these vacua. Now, the solutions that we're really interested in are these confining backgrounds. And as I mentioned, these confining backgrounds are given in the field theory by n copies of the one-dimensional representation. So they're given by the case here of p equals to n, where we really have, where the gauge group is, p equals p equals to one in this language, where the SUN is just classically, p equals to n in this language, where the SUN is not broken classically. And if we just continue this logic, then this suggests that we should describe these vacua by putting in n d-phi variance here into the bulk. However, we see that obviously we cannot do that, because then g string times n would be large, and the back reaction of these phi variance would be large. So we would not be able to trust any supergravity analysis of these solutions, or even a weakly coupled string theory analysis, because the open string coupling on these d-brains would be large. So at first sight, it looks like we're in trouble, and even though we can construct here using supergravity plus these sources, we can construct the Higgs vacua, it looks like we cannot construct the vacua that we're really interested in, namely these confining vacua. However, luckily, that's not the case. And we can use another trick to enable us to describe these vacua as well in some different way. And the trick that we need to use is to remember that the n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory has an electromagnetic duality symmetry that inverts its coupling constant and exchanges the electric field with the magnetic field in this theory. So the n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory has a complexified coupling constant, tau, defined in the following way, which includes the Young-Mills coupling and the theta angle. And the theory has an SL2Z duality symmetry acting on this, is believed to have an SL2Z duality symmetry acting on this tau parameter. And in particular, there's the electric magnetic duality transformation that takes tau to minus 1 over tau. Now, why is this useful for us? It's useful because in the Higgs vacuum, as we mentioned, we have this condensate of these fields phi, which are charged under the electric gauge group. So we have an electrically charged condensate. And that means that in the Higgs vacua, if we try to turn on an electric field, then it would, of course, be screened. So electric fields in this vacua, that means that, yeah. So if we try to turn on an electric field in this vacua, then it would be screened by this condensate. And if we try to turn on some magnetic field in this Higgs vacuum, then it would be confined, just like in the Meissner effect, when we turn on some charged condensate in a superconductor, then that confines the magnetic field to a narrow flux tube. Now, these considerations tell us that if we act on this vacuum by this electromagnetic duality transformation, then we should find some alternative vacuum where we have some condensate of magnetic sources in some sense. And in this vacuum, which is related to this by this duality transformation, we should have a screening of magnetic fields, and we should have confinement of electric fields, just because this duality transformation exchanges the two. And of course, this property is exactly the property that we expect to have in these confining vacua. So what we call a confining vacuum is, of course, a vacuum where the original electric gauge field is confined. So the claim is that this SL2Z duality transformation exchanges the Higgs vacuum with one of the confined vacua. So, well, as we said, we really have n confined vacua, but you can do this more carefully and see that one of those vacua is exchanged by this transformation with the Higgs vacuum. So that's just a general property of this mass deformed n equals 4 field theory that you can see on the field theory side. Now, why is this useful for us? It's useful for us because we know how to realize this SL2Z duality transformation also on the string theory side. On the string theory side, this transformation just maps to the SL2Z duality transformation of the type 2B string theory that acts on in the type 2B string theory on the string coupling and on the Ramon-Ramon axion. So we know how to realize this duality transformation in the string theory. And as I said, we do have a good description of the Higgs vacuum in string theory, given by this configuration with a single B5 brain sitting here in the bulk. So one way to describe the confining vacuum is just to start from this Higgs vacuum, do this S duality transformation, and that would give us a description of the confined vacuum. So we can do that. So we just need to take this configuration that we constructed here and do this S duality transformation on it. This S duality transformation in the type 2B string theory, well, it acts in some particular way on the supergravity field, which is known. So we can see how it acts on the supergravity fields near the boundary. And the more important thing that it does is that it permutes the Ramon-Ramon three-form field with an SNS three-form field, and it maps the D5 brain to a Nevis-Schwarz 5 brain. So this configuration that we had with a single D5 brain is mapped by this S duality transformation to a configuration with a single Nevis-Schwarz 5 brain. Again, still carrying n units of three-form flux, n units of gauge field flux, which map into this five-ring carrying n units of three-form flux, because the five-form field, which the three rings are charged under, is invariant under the S-duality, so that doesn't change. So the claim is that that this configuration, where we have a single NS five-ring sitting somewhere in the bulk here, charged under this R4 cross S2, is the configuration which should be identified in the field theory with the confining vacuum that we're interested in. And again, and you could argue that the back reaction of this five brain is small. So even though naively we were led to describe this vacuum by configuration of ND five brains that have some very strong back reaction, then somehow after all the back reaction has taken place and we took all that into account, then we end up in an alternative description of the same vacua, where we have just a single Nevis-Schwarz 5 ring, and again, we can just solve the supergravity equations by taking the NS5 ring to be a source for the supergravity fields and find a solution of this type. And again, this is the solution that we're interested in. So that's the solution that describes the confining vacua. And again, we can find similar solutions for all the other vacua, As I said, this theory actually has a huge number of different vacui, and for each of these vacui in the field theory, you can find some configuration of brains in the interior that would describe that vacuum correctly. So general vacua would be described by some collection of various different D brains and S5 brains scattered here along the radial position and all wrapping some S2 inside the S5. And in general, these vacua would not have a mass gap because you would have some massless gauge fields living on these D brains. But in the specific case of the confining vacuum, it maps to just a single Navier-Schwarz five brain in this way. Now, this was all for, so as I mentioned, in principle, one can find all these gravity solutions, although in practice, they have not yet been found exactly. And one could also generalize all of this to the case without supersymmetry. So here I described it for the supersymmetric case, but as I mentioned, you could also add a mass term for the fourth fermion here and break supersymmetry completely. And similar solutions with five brains in the bulk are supposed to exist also in this case where you break supersymmetry completely. And it seems like from the point of view of this bulk physics, there isn't really too much of a difference between the case with or without supersymmetry. As I mentioned, the only difference is that without supersymmetry, you would have some non-zero vacuum energy for each of these different vacua, and one of them would have the lowest energy, and actually it's not known which one. But otherwise, there's no problem in principle in constructing these gravity solutions plus brains, whether or not you have supersymmetry. So that's all that I want to say about the form of these solutions. Are there any questions so far? Yes. That's right. So you saw already in this case that in subsets have exchanged n and 1. And in the general case, if you have a vacuum that's described by PD5 brains, then you could also describe it in terms of Q and Navier-Schwarz 5 brains. But it's always the case that at least one of these descriptions is always going to be strongly coupled, and so it's not really going to be a good description. But if you're lucky, then one of these descriptions will be good, and you can really trust supergravity to construct that solution. Indeed. And similarly, also the other vacua, they might have many different descriptions in terms of brains, but always all the descriptions except for maybe one would always be strongly coupled. And if you're lucky, you would have one description in terms of brains that's weakly coupled and where you can really trust this supergravity plus brains. Yes. Right. So all of these solutions, all the flux is carried by the brains, and they all interpolate between ADS5 process 5 and just flat space in the interior. That's right. So that's a property of all of these solutions, indeed. Any other questions? Yes. Can you talk louder? So I'll discuss in a moment. I mean, so that's the scale of the mass gap. So I'll discuss in a moment how you see the mass gap in this picture. And I hope that will become clear, and ask me later if it's not clear. Any other questions? OK, so now that we have these solutions, our goal is to try to see if they really give us a good approximation to large NQCD. So we want to see whether in these solutions we can see all the nice qualitative properties of QCD that we want to see. So we want to ask whether these backgrounds really exhibit these phenomena of dynamically forming a mass gap and confining and all these other properties of QCD, which are usually difficult to see in perturbation theory. So first we can ask whether these vacua really have a mass gap or not. So again, in the cases which are just well described by supergravity plus brains, it's easy to just compute the spectrum of these configurations. So for instance, if we want to compute the spectrum of the supergravity fields, we just have to look for solutions to the supergravity equations in this background given by that solution. So we take some gravity fields and we look for solutions that are of the form e to the I k mu x mu in the four directions of flat space times some function of the other coordinates, z and the angular coordinates of the S5. And so we look for solutions to the field equations of this form. And what we find is that indeed solutions like that exist, and they exist with a discrete spectrum of values for k squared, which we identify with minus the mass squared of the corresponding fields in the four-dimensional field theory, given the usual relation between mass and momentum. So for each of the supergravity fields, you can just do a complete mode expansion of the solution to its equation of motion, and you find that each of these fields leads to a discrete spectrum of masses in the field theory, and all the fields that arise are massive. So just from solving these gravity equations, just one second, we find a discrete spectrum of masses. So you can actually even, not only do you find a mass graph, but you can also explicitly compute the spectrum of fields. So you find some spectrum. So if this is mass squared equals zero, then you just find some discrete spectrum of fields. And similarly, you can analyze the fields living on the brains, and also for them you find some discrete spectrum of fields. So all the modes here, both in the bulk and on the brains, have some discrete spectrum. And you interpret that as the spectrum of the glue balls in the field theory in the large unlimit. So the fact that you have a mass gap really just follows automatically from the solution. So there was a question. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't. You just put it in as a source in the equations. And yeah, that's right. So I mean, well, it's a source if you want. So it's just a source in the field equations. I mean, of course, you already have a solution with that source, and you're just looking at fluctuations around that solution. So in the fluctuations, you don't really see the source term anymore. I mean, you just solve the equations. It's a completely standard analysis. And well, you might have thought that because you have this R10 region, then it might be surprising that the spectrum is continuous, is discrete, because of course in R10 the spectrum is not really, I mean, it's continuous of course and not discrete, but this R10 region here is really finite, and it's only a small, relatively small region of R10 which eventually is replaced by this ADS, and of course you have to find solutions which are consistent in the full space, and so when you do that, then you find that the spectrum is indeed discrete. I'm sorry? You mean the radial position? No, that's invariant because, well, I mean, this is in some sense part of the, I mean, this is part of the metric, and the metric is invariant under residuality. So I guess, it depends if you measure it in the string frame or in the Einstein frame, but if you measure this position in the Einstein frame, then it doesn't change because the Einstein frame metric is invariant under residuality. Any other questions? Yes. That's right. So, of course, in the field theory, we don't really know how to compute the spectrum. I mean, well, obviously we don't know it at strong coupling, and even at weak coupling, this phenomenon of forming a mass gap is a non-perturbative phenomenon, so we don't know how to compute the spectrum in the field theory, even at weak coupling, and certainly not at strong coupling. So this gives us a prediction for what the spectrum of this field theory should be in the limit of lambda goes to infinity, where it's well described by supergravity. And of course, that's the opposite limit for Young-Mills theory, so this doesn't give us any predictions directly for the Young-Mills theory, but qualitatively, we see that we have the same properties of having a discrete spectrum with a gap. Of course, in the spectrum, we only find fields of spin less than or equal to 2, as we mentioned. Whenever you have a supergravity dual, it will only include fields of spin less than or equal to 2. But in principle, you can then also analyze the string excitations in the spectrum, and they will be much more massive, but they will give you also higher spins. So in principle, if you could really solve string theory in this background, you would also then find additional higher mass modes that carry higher spins. Yes? I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, the solution has a source in it, and you have to solve the equations for the gravity fields plus the source. And again, you can solve for the modes of the gravity fields and for the modes that live on the D-brain. So you have this coupled system of equations, but you know how to solve it. And all of these, the fluctuations of all these fields, both in the bulk and on the brain, give you this discrete spectrum of modes in the field theory. Yes? Well, there is no limit of m going to 0. M here is the only scale in this theory, so there's no meaning to asking what the value of m is. Any non-zero value of m is equivalent because that's the only scale, and any dimensionful quantity is just measured in units of m, so there is... But again, this is not a parameter. I mean, all different values of m are equivalent because they're just related by conformal transformations. So there's no sense in talking about a limit of m going to 0. M is just a scale. I mean, just like in QCD, there's no meaning to ask what happens if lambda QCD goes to 0. That's the only scale of the theory, and there's no sense to taking different limits of it. I mean, everything that you measure, I mean, so of course, this mass gap, the spectrum of masses squared, every mass would be given by some number times the small m squared, because that's the only scale in the theory. So all these masses would be given by different numbers times m squared. And there's no sense in taking the limit of m going to 0. Of course, when m is equal to 0, then you know that the solution is just ADS5 for SS5. But there's no smooth limit of going from taking m to 0, because, again, all different values of m are equivalent except for 0. So there's no sensible. The size of this S2? Well, this S2 is just inside the S5. I mean, if you do it carefully, then this S2 is actually an equator inside the S5, so it's really the maximum. The S5 has some radius which grows with n, and this S2 is just some equator of this S5, essentially. So for large n, this S2 is large, and of course that's crucial for really being able to describe this by a weakly coupled background. If this S2 was small, then you would not be able to do that, but this S2 is always large in this limit of large to string times n, and therefore you can trust this gravity approximation. Any other questions? Okay, so this mass gap, as you see, we get almost for free from solving the supergravity equations. Another interesting property which we'd want to see is whether we have confinement in this background, or more precisely, for instance, we expect that in the Higgs vacuum we should have screening if we put in some external electric sources. Well, in the confining vacuum, we should find confinement. So how does that work? So you've already heard in the lectures about ADS-CFT how we put in external electric sources in the theory. So you heard this when you studied Wilson loops. The way to put in external electrically charged sources is to just put in some string that ends on the boundary here. That's the object that maps to the Wilson loop. So string ending on the boundary is what corresponds to putting in, say, some external quark and anti-quark into the theory in the fundamental representation. And then we can ask whether the force between these external quarks and anti-quarks which you put in, we want to see whether that force is screened or confined depending on the vacuum. And that's actually quite easy to see. So we put in these quarks now in, let's say, some different positions in the four-dimensional space. I guess this drawing is not very good. I should maybe draw a different drawing where now this is, say, one of the positions x mu. And so here we put in some source quark and anti-quark. And in the ADSI, that maps to having some fundamental string extending to the boundary. And we want to ask, what's the minimal energy configuration for that string that would give us the dominant contribution to the path integral that would tell us what's the force between these quarks and anti-quarks. Now, in the Higgs vacuum, then, as we said, we have a D5 brain sitting here in the bulk. And one of the properties of a D5 brain is that a fundamental string can just end on it. And that's actually the minimal energy configuration. If these quarks and anti-quarks are far enough, the minimal energy configuration comes from just having these fundamental strings end here on the D5 brain. And that's what corresponds to screening. You can see that the force between these external quarks and anti-quarks decays when you try to separate them, as you would expect from a vacuum with screening. So in the Higgs vacuum, you find, and in all the other vacua that have a good description in terms of D brains, you find that you have screening. On the other hand, if you look in the confining vacuum, then that vacuum is described, as we said, in terms of having a Navier-Schwarz 5 brain in the bulk, and fundamental strings cannot end on Navier-Schwarz 5 brains. So if you look at what's the minimal energy configuration in this case, then the string wants to go close to the 5 brain because it's attracted to it, but then it doesn't end, it just continues going parallel to this Navier-Schwarz 5 brain, and then goes back out again. And this segment of the string has some finite tension, so that you find that the potential between the quark and anti-quark, if they're separated by some distance r, then you find that the energy grows like some tension times r, as you would expect in a confining vacuum. And again, it's not hard to exactly compute the confining string tension in this configuration just by analyzing the tension of this string that stretches along this Navier-Schwarz 5 brain. So you can compute exactly this confining string tension and see that indeed you have confinement in this vacuum. As I mentioned, whenever we're in the supergravity approximation, of course, this confining string tension turns out to be much bigger than the scale lambda QCD squared, which is the characteristic scale of this spectrum. But as I mentioned, this is a general feature of this large lambda limit. And when we take lambda to be small and go to the QCD limit, we expect that these two scales should become comparable. So both of these features of confinement and a mass gap, which are quite mysterious from the point of view of Young-Mills theory, are very easily seen in these dual stringy descriptions, just as properties of the gravity fields and of strings in this background. Are there any questions about this? Okay, so these are the more complicated properties. Of course, you can go on and compute many other things in these vacua. You can see various other properties of QCD. You can analyze instanton effects and compare them to what you expect in QCD. You can put in, say, n external quarks and see if you could form a baryon vertex that couples them, and you see that indeed everything that you check behaves in a similar way to what you would expect from QCD. You can compute vacuum expectation values of various fields. For instance, you can compute the VEV of this operator trace lambda lambda. And if you compute condensates of chiral fields, then you can even compare them to the field theory, because as I mentioned, in the supersymmetric case, we actually know how to compute these condensates of chiral fields exactly in the field theory based on various sophisticated supersymmetry techniques. And you find that, of course, there's an exact agreement between these condensates that you compute from the string theory and the condensates that you compute in the field theory, and so on. So basically, all the qualitative properties of QCD you can find also in this background, in the gravity, which suggests that, indeed, the qualitative properties of this theory don't depend too much on this parameter lambda. We find the same things at large lambda as we expect to find at small lambda. And presumably, as you vary lambda, all these qualitative properties should just remain. But of course, the quantitative details, like the details of this mass spectrum and of the string tension, would change considerably as you change lambda. But it looks like none of the qualitative properties change. So this theory is, in some sense, in the same universality class as Large and Young-Mills theory for any value of this Etoft coupling lambda, at least when we're in this confining vacuum. Of course, the other vacua certainly have different qualitative properties, but the confining vacuum seems to be in the same universality class as the Larger and Young-Mills theory. So, any questions? Yes. So that's actually not hard to see. One easy way to see it is to note that these n different confining vacua, they're also related by SL2Z transformations. So as I said, there's the tau going to minus one transformation, which exchanges these two vacua, and the transformation of tau going to tau plus one permutes all of these different vacua. You remember that this just shifts the theta angle in the Young-Mills theory, and that's what permutes these vacua, even also in the n equals one super Young-Mills theory. So this is again a transformation that we know how to do for d-brains, and that exchanges these NS5 brains. So if you take tau to tau plus one, then an NS5 brain goes into what's called a 1-1-5 brain, which is a bound state of an NS5 brain with a d5 brain that carries one unit of d5 brain charge and one unit of NS5 brain charge. So that's the configuration that gives you the next confining vacua. And similarly, you can do this transformation any number of times and get all of these different vacua of the field theory. So again, as I mentioned, not all of these vacua necessarily have a good gravity approximation. Some of them will end up being strongly coupled, but at least you can see that you have the right number of vacua, and you can construct all of them here. And again, you can also compute the Scalino condensate in all of these vacua and see that it matches with the field theory. Any other questions? Okay, so this basically concludes our description of this method to get string duals of large n QCD. Let me end just by mentioning what are the advantages and disadvantages of this method compared to other methods. So we didn't yet study the other methods, but I guess these comments should become clear after we study also the other methods. So this method of accessing the string dual to large n QCD has two big advantages compared to the other methods that we'll discuss next. One big advantage is that the field theory interpretation of this construction is very simple. We just start from the sine equals Fourier angles theory, deform it by these mass terms, so we know exactly what we're doing in the field theory, and it's very easy to analyze it and to analyze the field theory and even compute many things exactly. So that will turn out not to be the case in the other vacua that we'll, in the other ways to approach QCD that we'll discuss. And the second big advantage of this case is that it has a simple generalization to non-supersymmetric backgrounds. As I mentioned, there's in terms of finding these gravity solutions, there's nothing special about the supersymmetric case. You can find similar configurations of five brains also when you break supersymmetry. Of course, in those cases, you have to verify if the solution is stable or not, and that's in practice, it's quite complicated to do that. But the general analysis of the non-supersymmetric cases is not really more difficult than the supersymmetric cases, and again, that will turn out not to be the case in the other examples that we'll consider. So these are two big advantages. However, this solution also has a very big disadvantage. And the big disadvantage is that you remember that we started from saying that we want to describe the Larsen-Yang-Mills theory just as some string theory, and which would hopefully have some supergravity approximation. Now, what we found is that in this case, even at large lambda, so even at large lambda, we found that there wasn't really just a supergravity approximation. We needed to add brains. So the description was not just in supergravity, but it was in terms of supergravity plus brains. Now, a priori, for analyzing the large lambda theory, that's not too much of a problem because, as we said, we know how to analyze the lower energy theory of brains. We know how they couple to gravity, so that doesn't really stop us from doing computations. But it is a big problem if we want to really study this. So eventually, of course, we want to understand what these string theories are and then take the limit of lambda going to zero in order to find the string theory dual of QCD. And there we run into big problems because not only do we have brains here, but if we want to describe the confining vacua, then we have Nevesh-Schwarz five brains in the background. And these five brains are solitons of string theory, and we don't really have a good way to describe them in perturbative string theory. So even though we hoped that large NQCD should just be described by a normal perturbative string theory, then here we find that even at large lambda, these backgrounds are not just described by a normal perturbative string theory, but they have these five brains in them, and near the five brain, the string coupling becomes large and perturbation theory breaks down. So these backgrounds don't really have a good perturbative string description. So even though, as far as the supergravity approximation is concerned, that these backgrounds are fine, then if we really want to use these backgrounds as a dual for Yang-Mills theory, then we're in trouble because we don't know how to do string perturbation theory. These vacua are not just described by some sigma model, like we would hope that the actual large Yang-Mills is, but we have these additional brains. So that's a big problem if we really want to understand these backgrounds fully and eventually take the small lambda limit and use these as a construction of the QCD string. So this concludes our discussion of these deformed backgrounds. Are there any further questions about them? Okay, so let's move on now to the second method of approaching Yang-Mills theory. And the second method will be compactifications. So instead of starting from a four-dimensional theory and breaking supersymmetry explicitly as we did here, another way to do it is to start from a higher dimensional supersymmetric theory for which we know the string theory dual, and then break supersymmetry by compactifying this theory on some manifold, and that way eventually at low energies, so compactifying it to four dimensions and eventually flowing at low energies to the n equals one or n equals zero Yang-Mills theories that we're interested in. There are two main scenarios of compactification that were analyzed in the literature. One of these, I think you already heard about in the lectures of Sujong Ray. That's the case of taking a configuration of n D4 brains and putting it on a circle with antiperiodic boundary conditions for the fermions. So these antiperiodic boundary conditions break supersymmetry completely and give a mass to all the fermions such that at low energies you end up with a four-dimensional field theory in which all the extra fermions are massive and also the scalars should get a mass by quantum corrections. So this, in principle, should lead you to the pure Yang-Mills theory at low energies. And the second case, which has been analyzed, is to take n of these Noether-Schwarz fibrains and put them on a three-sphere, on a two-sphere. And as I'll discuss in a moment, if you do it in an appropriate way, then this can lead at low energies to the n equals 1 super Young Mills theory. I will not discuss here the first case, both because you already heard a bit about it, and also because in this case, when you construct the string dual, then you find that it's actually strongly coupled in some places, and it's not really, well, it's never given by a weakly coupled and weakly curved string theory as we want. So I'll focus here on this second scenario. Of course, in principle, one could also do many other scenarios, but it will turn out that this scenario has the advantage of really mapping in an appropriate limit to a weakly coupled and weakly curved background, and without any brains or any trouble like that. And also, as we'll see, it can even be mapped to a background that doesn't have any Ramon field. So that will be a big advantage in terms of constructing the actual string theory in this background. So we want to build the decoupled theory living on these NS fibrains. For instance, you can think of these as NS fibrains that wrap some two-sphere in a Calabi-Yau compactification. In a case like that, you can see that the theory has n equals 1 supersymmetry, and that the lower energy theory on these brains is really the n equals 1 Young-Mills theory. Before I describe this decoupling limit, let's start by just describing the decoupling limit of NS fibrains in flat space. And how does that work? I guess I should have said that I'm talking about NS fibrains here in the type 2B string theory. That's the case that will turn out to be interesting for this. So how do we describe the decoupling limit of Noether-Schwarz fibrains in flat space? In the type 2B string theory, we can use the fact that these objects are related by S-duality, as I already mentioned, to D fibrains. So if we want to describe the decoupled limit on them, then it will turn out to be the same as just the decoupled theory living on D fibrains. How do we take a decoupling limit if we have some theory on DP brains, how do we take the decoupling limit of that? So you already heard about the case of D3 brains in the context of ADS5 cross S5. What we want to do to take a decoupling limit is we want to take the Planck length to zero, and we want to keep the gauge coupling on these D brains fixed in order to remain with some interacting decoupled theory. So we want to take L Planck to zero to decouple the theory on the brains from gravity and from the other closed string fields, and we want to keep G Young Mills fixed in order to remain with a non-trivial interacting theory. Now L Planck in string theory goes like just string square times alpha prime to the fourth, and the gauge coupling on DP brains goes like G string times alpha prime to the power p minus 3 over 2, basically just on dimensional grounds. And so we want to take some limit of the parameters of the theory, namely G string and alpha prime, such that this L Planck will go to 0 and G Young Mills squared will be kept fixed. So in the case of p equals 3, of course, it's very easy to do that. If for p equals 3, this factor is not here, and you just take alpha prime to 0, you just take the usual lower energy limit, and that decouples the D3 bins from the Balkan and gives you the usual ADS-CFT correspondence. If p is less than 3, then it's also not so hard to do that. You take both G string and alpha prime to 0 in some correlated way such that G Young Mills is kept fixed. However, we want to discuss the case of p equals 5, and for p equals 5, we see that if we really want to take this Planck length to 0 and keep the Young Mills coupling constant fixed, then we actually have to take G string to infinity and alpha prime to 0. And so in this case, this Young Mills coupling constant is just proportional to alpha prime times G string, which we want to keep fixed. So we have to take alpha prime to 0 and G string to infinity in such a way that keeps their product fixed. So that will, when we take them to 0 in this way, then the Planck length will still go to 0, so we'll still decouple gravity. But we will remain with an interacting theory on these D brains because the Young-Mills coupling will be kept constant. However, of course, the problem is that we have to take the string coupling to infinity to do that. But in the type 2B string theory, that's not really too much of a problem because we have this S-duality symmetry that relates strong and weak coupling. So we can just find a dual description of the same decoupling limit by going to the S-dual picture. And in the S-dual picture, these D5 brains just map to Noether-Schwarz fibrains. So if you do an S-duality transformation on this, then you find that the decoupling limit involves taking Noether-Schwarz fibrains, taking the string coupling in this case to 0, And it turns out that from the point of view of the S-dual theory, then alpha prime is kept fixed. In fact, also, if you look at the lower energy limit of the theory living on these n Nevill Schwartz firebrands, then you find that it is an SUN six-dimensional gauge theory with the Young-Mills coupling, which is just given by alpha prime. So it's obvious that to take the decoupling limit and keep the theory interacting, you have to keep alpha prime fixed. So that's the limit that we're interested in to find a decoupled limit on Nevill Schwartz firebrands. And of course, the big difference between this and the usual limit that you heard about for D-firebrands is that here we're keeping alpha prime fixed. So we're still keeping, in some sense, a fixed string scale in this theory. And for that reason, the resulting theory is not just a usual field theory, but it's called a little string theory, because even though it's decoupled from gravity, it still has a finite string scale parameter alpha prime in it, which governs some of the properties of the theory. And this little string theory is not just a normal field theory. So even though at low energies it reduces to this six-dimensional SUN gauge theory, then the theory that you find is actually not just a local field theory. It has various strange properties. For instance, it has, if you compute the density of states in this theory, then it actually grows exponentially, like the spectrum of a string theory with some typical Hagedorn growth. Another strange property of this theory is that it turns out to have a continuous spectrum above a mass gap, unlike standard field theories. And another strange property of the theory that you get here is that when you compactify it on a circle, then you have a T-duality symmetry, taking R to alpha prime over R, just like in the usual weakly coupled string theory. But despite all these strange properties, then it is still a theory that's decoupled from gravity, and which one can try to discuss. And well, the way to analyze this theory and the way that all these strange properties of the theory were derived is to see what is the holographic dual of this background. So for that, we have to just take the solution of n Nevill Schwartz firebrands and take this limit of the solution to see what's the dual description, just like you can do for the solution of D-firebrands, taking the decoupling limit and see what you get. And in this case, so the holographic dual of this little string theory turns out actually to be a very simple background. The string Frey metric of this background is just given by a flat six-dimensional space plus radial coordinate plus a three-sphere of radius square root of n. And there's also a linear dilaton in this background, so the string coupling turns out to go like e to the minus rho over square root of n. And there's also some three units of free-form flux on this S3, so the Nevill Schwartz firebrand is a charged for the NS and S3-form flux. And as usual, this flux is carried on the S3 in this geometry. So the holographic dual is very simple in this case. You can use it to do various computations of the type that I mentioned here. So again, at lower energies, this little string theory just reduces to a six-dimensional field theory. But of course, the six-dimensional field theory by itself is not normalizable, and it doesn't make any sense. So as you go up in energy, eventually you find that the theory has additional degrees of freedom, which are the degrees of freedom of this little string theory. And you also find that it has all these rather strange properties. So that's the decoupling limit of Nevill Schwartz firebrands in flat space. And what we want to do is to compactify this theory in a way that will break part of the supersymmetry, and that will lead us eventually to a theory that is close to the n equals 1 super Young-Mills theory. So you see that we have here these six-dimensional gauge fields of low energies, and then if we compactify the theory, we'll get some four-dimensional gauge fields. And if we do this appropriately, then we can get exactly the n equals 1 Young-Mills theory at low energies. So that's what we're going to try to do. So questions before that? I don't think it has any good interpretation. It's just a property of these theories. I mean, you can compute the spectrum. That's what you find. It doesn't have any good interpretation. Any other questions? OK, so what we want to do is to compactify this theory. And so this So this, in principle, gives us, again, a dual of this theory that thermal energies is a six-dimensional gauge theory, but we want to study four-dimensional gauge theory, so we have to compactify two of these dimensions. The simplest thing is to compactify the two dimensions on a torus, but compactification on a torus doesn't break the supersymmetry, and then, in this case of low energies, we would just get n equals 4 Young-Wells theory, which is not very interesting because we already know the dual description of that. So the way to compactify and break supersymmetry is to put the theory on a two-sphere. Now, if you just naively compactify a supersymmetric theory on a two-sphere, then actually you break the supersymmetry completely. But when you compactify these theories on a two-sphere, then you actually have a choice of which spin structure you choose on the two-sphere. And there are specific ways to choose the spin structure on the two-sphere, which enable you, you can choose the spin structure for the various fermions in the theory in various ways, in such that you either break the supersymmetry down to n equals 2, or the case that's interesting for us is the case where you break this the supersymmetry to n equals 1. So there's a well-known formalism of how you do this. And when you choose the specific compactification, then you can see that indeed at low energies, at low energies, you just get the six-dimensional gauge theory compactified on this S2, and you have a full closed Klein spectrum of modes. And you can see that there is a massless four-dimensional gauge field, and then a closed Klein tower of massive gauge fields. The scalars all become massive when you do this compactification, so you don't remain with any four-dimensional massless scalars. And if you choose the specific spin structure, then one of the adjoint fermions also has a zero mode on the sphere, and all the other ones are massive. So with low energies, you have n equals 1 super Young-Wells. And of course, above that, you have both Kaluza-Klein modes on the S2. And also, so that just comes from taking the six-dimensional gauge theory and compactify it. And of course, in addition to that, at high enough energies, you have also all these little string theory modes in the game. So as I mentioned, in all of these theories that we'll discuss, we take our Young-Wells theory and add to it some more degrees of freedom in order to enable us to have a supergravity description. So here we're really adding, in some sense, two types of new degrees of freedom to the theory, both these six-dimensional Kaluza-Klein modes and the little string theory modes. So we're adding quite a lot, but still, as we'll see, this theory will have many features that are similar to just the Young-Wells theory that we're interested in, despite all these additions that we made. I'm sorry? What do you mean? So the next thing we need to analyze is, just like we did in the deformation case, is what's the ratio between the masses of these modes and the masses of the modes that we're interested in. So we have to check what's the scale of the super Young-Wells theory that we get at low energies. How does that compare to the masses of these other modes? So we have the Kaluza-Klein modes are, of course, characterized by a mass scale, which is 1 over the radius of this S2. And the little string theory modes turn out to be characterized by a scale which is 1 over square root n alpha prime. That turns out to be the characteristic scale of the excited stringy modes of this little string theory. And of course, what we want in order to decouple is we want lambda of the Young-Wells theory to be much smaller than these two energy scales. So that would be the limit where we really decouple all the other modes. So when we do this compactification, of course, we have a dimensionless parameter, which is the radius of this S2 measured in units of this string tension 1 over alpha prime, which we kept fixed. So we have here a dimensionless parameter. And the hope is, again, that in one limit of that parameter, we'll have this decoupling and we'll get just the Young-Wells theory at low energies. But of course, as we described on general grounds, in that limit, we won't have a good supergravity description. And the hope is that in some other limit, we could have perhaps a good supergravity description. So how do we compute the Young-Wells scale? So we just treat this as a six-dimensional theory, gauge theory compactified on a two-sphere. So if we just write down the super Young-Wells Lagrangian, then classically we find that the Young-Wells coupling of the four-dimensional theory is just given by taking the six-dimensional Lagrangian, which had a coupling alpha prime, and compactifying it. Then we find that it's given by alpha prime divided by R squared, where this R squared just comes from the volume of the two-sphere, which multiplies the gauge kinetic term of the four-dimensional field. So this is the classical gauge coupling that we get for this low-energy four-dimensional theory. But of course, this four-dimensional theory is not conformal. The gauge coupling in it runs. So this gauge coupling that we compute here is really the gauge coupling at the scale 1 over r, because that's the, in some sense, the scale where we computed this, where we decoupled all the hierarchical cyclic modes, and we're left just with a four-dimensional gauge field. So below the scale, the coupling starts running in the usual way that you would expect for a four-dimensional gauge theory. And then, so this you should identify in some sense as the cutoff scale where we computed the Young-Mills coupling, and then you can use the usual formulas for the relation between the Young-Mills coupling at some scale and the strong coupling scale lambda. And so you find that the strong coupling scale of the super Young-Mills theory goes like 1 over r times e to the minus, well, the numerical factors here are not too important, but you find this relation just by plugging into the formulas for the running of the coupling constant. You plug in the fact that at this scale, the coupling constant is given by alpha prime over r squared, and you plug in the fact that the one loop beta function of this Lorentz Young-Mills theory is given by 3 times n. So that gives you this formula. And what this tells you is that if you want, so what we want is for this Young-Mills theory to be, the characteristic scale of this Young-Mills theory to be much smaller than 1 over r. And what we see is that for that to happen, we need r to be much bigger than 1 over square root of n alpha prime. So then this number here would be small, and this exponential would be very small, and we'd have a big gap between these two scales. So again, we have here this dimensionless parameter, which is the ratio between these two scales. And we find that in this limit, so this is the limit where we really get the super Young-Mills theory to be decoupled. And as we'll see, in the opposite limit, we have a good description in terms of supergravity and weakly coupled strings and so on. So this is the limit which is analogous to the limit of taking lambda to 0 from the point of view of the deformed theory that we discussed before. Any questions so far? Okay, so now all that we need to do is we just need to repeat this exercise of taking the near horizon limit for the Navier-Schwartz fibrains for Navier-Schwartz fibrains that are wrapped on an S2. So we could, again, we could just take this S2 to be in a Calabi-Yau and take some solution of string theory where we have this Navier-Schwartz fibrain, and then take this decoupling limit of taking Z-string to 0 and alpha prime fixed and see what's the solution that we get. So I won't describe exactly how this solution is found, but the solution that describes this decoupling limit of NS fibrains on the S2 was found by Maldacena and Nunez based on a previous solution that was found by Shamsuddin and Volkov, and they showed that this solution of gravity that was found by Shamsuddin and Volkov can be really interpreted as the solution for the Navier-Schwartz fibrains on S2 in this decoupling limit. Yes. I'm sorry? Yeah, oh, sorry, that's right, of course, right. Sorry, yeah, thank you. Right, So we have these two typical scales in the theory, and we see that one of them has to be much bigger than the other in order to have this decoupling. So what does the solution look like? So of course we expect that asymptotically, at very high energies, you shouldn't really notice the quantification, so the solution should look very similar to the solution of this, of the decoupling limit of NS fibrains in flat space. So for large radial positions, you find a solution which is similar to the one that we had before, except that instead of having this R6, so here these dx mu squared were six-dimensional. These were the six-dimensional world volume coordinates of the little string theory. But so instead of having this R6, you find that you have an R4 cross S2, as you would expect. But of course, there's a problem that having an S2, just an S2 is not a solution of string theory. And you find that the radius of this S2 is actually not constant in the solution, but you find that the radius of the S2 turns out to be proportional to this radial coordinate role, and that's what enables it to really be a good background of string theory. So the background So for large, so if this is the row coordinate, then in this region, the background looks like R4 across S2 across the linear dilaton coordinate across S3, where the only somewhat strange feature is that the radius of this S2 changes as we go along. On the other hand, when you take rho to 0, then it turns out that the radius of the S2 actually goes to 0 in the solution. And so that's maybe not too surprising. Well, the radius of the S3, of course, could not go to 0 because we still have these n units of 3 form flux on this S3. So the S3 could not go to 0. But it turns out that the radius of the S2 in this solution that you construct goes to 0. And it goes to 0 smoothly, just like just like an S2 in polar coordinates of some R3 in the solution. So the radius, so it goes to 0 like d rho squared plus rho squared d omega 2 squared. It goes to 0 in a completely smooth way. And that means that here near the origin, so near the minimal value of rho, so there is some origin here, say rho equals rho 0. And near here, the four-dimensional space, the S2 and the linear dilaton direction just merge together to become an R7. So here the solution just looks like R7 cross S3, where we still have these n units of flux on the S3. And the full solution just smoothly interpolates between these two different limits. So you can write down exactly the metric and the way that the volume of this S2 behaves and the way that the dilaton behaves and so on in this solution. Now, the solution turns out to have exactly one parameter, as we would expect. We said that there's always the string scale, but there's only one dimensionless parameter here, which should be related to this radius of the S2 in units of the string scale. And in the gravity solution, this dimensionless parameter turns out to be given by the value of the string coupling here at this minimal value of the rho coordinate. So I guess I should have mentioned already in this case that as we go to large radial positions, the string coupling goes to 0. So the coupling becomes weaker and weaker as we go to large radial distances, which is nice because that means we can really always trust the string perturbation theory here in this region of large rho. As we go inside, the string coupling grows. And in these solutions, it reaches some maximal position at rho equals rho 0. So this is the string at rho equals rho 0. So that's just given by some constant, and a solution like this exists for every value of this constant. So that's the dimensionless variable that characterizes that solution, or this class of solutions. So it's characterized by this dimensionless variable. And based on what we said, we expect that this dimensionless variable should be related to the radius of the S2 measured in units of square root n alpha prime. So we can try to relate the two, and at least, well, the so we can at least in the limit that the radius of the S2 is much bigger than square root n alpha prime. So that's the limit where it's a large radius and where we really know what we're talking about in terms of measuring the radius. Of course, in general, this is a complicated string theory, so a radius is not obviously well defined. But in the limit of large radius, then we know that we should have Kaluza Klein modes with this characteristic scale 1 over r and so on. So we know what we're talking about. And it turns out that in this limit, this radius squared divided by n alpha prime is proportional to the dilaton at the tip phi 0. So the limit that we're interested in order to decouple the Young-Mills theory, where this radius is much bigger than square root alpha prime, turns out to be the limit where this dilaton is large. So that's the strong coupling limit. And of course, in that limit, we cannot trust supergravity. So the decoupling limit is the limit that takes this ratio to be large and phi 0 to be very large. And there we have a strongly coupled theory, and we can't really control it. I'll say a few more words about it in a moment. But the other limit in this theory is the limit where we take this string coupling to be small. So we take phi 0 to minus infinity. And obviously, this relation breaks down. But in this other limit, where phi 0 goes to minus infinity, we have weak coupling here at this tip. And it turns out that we also have small curvatures everywhere and weak coupling everywhere, because the coupling just becomes weaker and weaker as we go off. So in this limit, we have a very good supergravity approximation, which allows us to compute anything we want. So here we do realize this hope that we had at the beginning of having one limit, which is just given by a supergravity solution, and another limit where the theory decouples. And moreover, in this background, so I guess I didn't mention this, but in this whole background, the only fields that are turned on are just the fields G mu nu, B mu nu, and the dilaton. There are never any Ramon-Ramon fields. Well, it's not too surprising because we just started from NS5 brains, but it's still nice that in this whole background, there are no Ramon-Ramon fields. So in principle, one could also describe this just by the usual string theory methods without having to deal with Ramon-Ramon fields. So are there any questions about the properties of the solution? Okay, so, we'll see if there will be a few minutes remaining at the end. I'll write down the explicit form of the solution. I mean, the solution in this case is explicitly known, but it takes a few lines to write it down. So to save some time, I think I won't write it down explicitly. You can find it in the paper of Molosena and Nunez and in the reference that I gave at the beginning. And again, the qualitative properties of the solution are just summarized in this picture that I drew. And again, we should ask ourselves, like we did in the previous case, whether this theory is in the same universality class as the Young-Wells theory or not. So we can ask whether we can, in this solution, see all these properties of confinement and mass gap and so on. And it turns out that indeed we can. So again, we can just compute the spectrum of supergravity fields in this background. When we're in this limit, supergravity is a good approximation. We just solve the gravity equations, find the solutions, and we find, again, that there is a discrete spectrum that has a mass gap. So we do find this feature just from this classical supergravity analysis. Similarly, we can ask about confinement. In this case, to analyze confinement, we have to introduce electric sources into this theory living on the Nevers-Schwarz fibrins and ask what's the force between them at long distances. In the case of D-brains, the way to do that was to insert fundamental strings because those give the electric charges in the world volume of the D-brains. For Nevers-Schwarz fibrins, it's actually, if you have a D1 brain ending on the Nevers-Schwarz fibrin, that gives you a particle which is electrically charged from the point of view of the world volume theory of these Nevers-Schwarz fibrins. I mean, that's, I guess, obvious by relating this by S-duality to the case of the D fibrins. So the way to ask if we have confinement or not here is to put in some D1 brains ending on some quark and anti-quark for large rho into this background and to ask what's the force between these external quarks and anti-quarks. So we put in these external D1 brains in this into this background, and well, it's pretty obvious that these D1 brains don't have anything to end on and they don't have anywhere to go. So what happens in the solution? I guess it's hard to draw it here, but if I draw it in a more reasonable scale where rho equals infinity is here and rho equals rho zero is here, then the D1 brains just want to go sit near the minimal value of rho and then go back out again. And they want to do this because the tension of these D1 brains goes like 1 over G string, and G string is very large here. So here they have high tension, but here G string reaches its maximal value. So this is where they have the lower tension. So these are the configurations that minimize the energy. And the D1 brain that sits here has some finite tension. So again, you find that the potential takes the confining form with some string tension that you can compute, which is just given by the tension of this D string that sits here at the minimal radial position. And of course, the string tension does depend on this dimensionless parameter, which is the string coupling at the tip. I mean, of course, it goes like 1 over G string at the tip because it's the tension of the D1 brain. And again, in this limit of very small phi zero, then you find that the string tension is much bigger than the characteristic scale that you find in the spectrum. While in the opposite limit, we hope that they become of the same order of magnitude. So are there any questions about these two features of the theory? Well, so again, so we need to construct objects that would be electrically charged in this gauge theory that lives on the Nevers-Schwarz firebrands. And it turns out that if you have a D1 brain that ends on the Nevers-Schwarz firebrands, then that indeed gives you precisely an electric charge in this world volume theory. And again, one easy way to see that is just to start from the case of D firebrands with a fundamental string ending on them. So then you know that the end of this fundamental string gives you a charged field in the world volume theory of these D firebrands. And then this maps by S duality to this configuration of Nevers-Schwarz firebrands. So if when you have D brains, then electric charges are given by fundamental strings. So just by S duality, when you have Nevers-Schwarz firebrands, then it's the D strings that give you the electric sources. Any other questions? Sorry? Yeah, so again, so you compute the tension just by putting in this D-string configuration, and you know how to write down the action. So this is a weakly curved and weakly coupled background. You just write down the Dirac Bohr infield action for these D-strings, and you just see what their energy is, and that gives you the tension. So well, basically, this tension in this case is just equal to this 1 over D-string at rho equals rho 0 times alpha prime. So it's just the usual string tension and D-string tension in this case. And the only thing to be careful about is that the string coupling that you should use is the one that sits here, because that's where these strings want to go, where they minimize their energy. So that's just a straightforward computation in string theory in this case. Well, if you would put in a fundamental string here, then you'd perhaps find a similar behavior, but there's no obvious interpretation here for what happens when you put in fundamental string. I mean, just like when you start from D firebrands, if you put in some D string, then, I mean, that since it can't end on the D brains, there's no obvious interpretation for that in terms of this gauge theory. So you could also put in fundamental strings in this background, but their interpretation in the field theory is not clear. While the interpretation of these D-strings is clear, they are just external electric sources, and the force between them gives you the confining force. The Twift loop in this case is more complicated, so you have to find a magnetic source for this theory on the NS firebrands, and that actually turns out to be given, well, because this is a six-dimensional theory, then the magnetic source is actually given by D3 brains that would end on this Nevers firebrand. And so here in the solution, you have to put in, instead of putting in these D strings, you have to put in D3 brains that are wrapped on the S2 that you have in your background. So you can also compute that if you want. But I'm not sure if anybody's actually done it, because that's a much more complicated computation in this background. Any other questions? Okay, so let me maybe mention just one more feature of this background, which is somewhat nice and that we didn't have in the previous case, and that's this question of chiral symmetry breaking. So as I already mentioned, if we just look at the n equals 1 super Young Mohs theory, then that has a U1 symmetry rotating the phase of the gluinos, which is a chiral symmetry. And this U1 symmetry is anomalous by the chiral anomaly, and the anomaly breaks it to Z2n. So when you just have n equals 1 super Young Mohs, then the anomaly breaks this U1 to Z2n, and then it's further spontaneously broken to Z2 in the vacuum. It turns out that these Mobile-Sanna Nunez solutions, even though they have many more degrees of freedom, they exhibit precisely the same pattern of symmetry breaking. So you can identify in these solutions a U1 global symmetry, which is related to a translation in one of the directions of this S3. So you can see just in supergravity that these solutions seem to have a U1 isometry that would give you a U1 global symmetry from the point of view of the field theory. And you can also see that this U1 isometry is in fact broken just at gravity to Z2n by the three-form flux. So you can analyze whether this isometry is really a symmetry of the full theory, including also the fluxes or not, and you find that it's only a symmetry if you do specific isometry transformations, which lie in this Z2n subgroup. So that you can see just by analyzing the solution in this asymptotic region, which corresponds to the UV region of the field theory. And if you look at the full solution, then you can also see that this Z2n symmetry is spontaneously broken to Z2. So even though the solution asymptotically, which we identify with the high energy region, has a full Z2n symmetry, then the solution at low energies actually only preserves a Z2 subgroup of this symmetry, so that even though we added all these additional degrees of freedom, it turns out that we have precisely the same symmetry breaking pattern as in the gauge theory. And here, all of this is visible just in classical supergravity. You don't have to know anything about anomalies, Gugino condensates, and all that. You see all of this just directly in classical gravity. And, well, similarly, you can discuss, again, all the other features of UCD. You can look at instantons, baryons, and so on. You can really compute anything you want. And again, you find that everything points out that this theory is, again, at lower energies, it's in the same universality class as the n equals 1 super Young Mohs theory. And you just have to vary this parameter. So again, for one limit of this parameter, you have a good supergravity approximation. And in the other limit, you would be able to decouple this n equals 1 super Young Mohs theory. So let me just end by mentioning the advantages and disadvantages of this approach to getting the string dual of the n equals 1 Young Mohs theory. So the big disadvantage of this scenario is that the higher energy theory in this case, these higher energy degrees of freedom that we added to the Young Mohs theory in order to enable us to have a good gravity description, is quite mysterious. It's this little string theory, which is not really well understood. We're not just adding here more field theory degrees of freedom at higher energies. We're really adding all of these mysterious little string theory descriptions. And we don't really have a direct field theory interpretation of this construction, unlike the previous case. However, the big advantage of this case, as I mentioned, is that we really have, in the appropriate limit, we really have not only weak coupling and curvature, but we also have no Ramond-Ramond fields. So this is really an ideal case for being able to describe this theory at low energies just by supergravity and at higher energies by a full string theory. So even though nobody has yet found what's precisely the string theory, the string world seat conformal field theory that describes these backgrounds, in principle, it should not be hard to do it because there are no Ramond-Ramond fields. So it should be easy to study this background. Of course, I should be careful and note that this advantage is only in this limit, which is analogous to the lambda equals infinity limit, where we have a good supergravity description. If we try to take the opposite limit of lambda going to zero, then this string coupling here at the tip actually becomes strong. So then we don't have weak coupling and weak curvatures anymore. You could try to get around this strong coupling problem by doing an S-duality transformation. And then, indeed, the string coupling here would become weak. But that has several problems. One problem is that even if the string coupling here would become weak, then the string coupling here would become strong in that case. So in this other limit, you would actually find strong coupling. And you also find that when you do this transformation, then the curvatures in this region also become large. So you also find strong curvatures. And finally, when you do this S-duality transformation, of course, the Nevesh-Schwarz three-form field becomes a Ramond-Ramond field. So you go back to all these problems of, in this limit, you do actually have strong coupling and strong curvatures and strong Ramond-Ramond fields. So even though there is one limit here where this theory is under great control, then in the limit that you're actually interested in, then not only are you in trouble because of the Ramond-Ramond fields, but also we have these problems of strong coupling and curvatures. So we're still not quite where we want to be. Where we have just some weakly coupled string dual of large and Young Mohs. So tomorrow we'll see how we can maybe improve on this situation. So are there any questions about this coupling scenario before we finish? OK, so tomorrow we'll continue with the third scenario, which will have its own advantages and disadvantages.